everyone. It's Natasha Crane. So a lot of people have been asking me how often I'm going to do new podcast episodes, and I would love to be able to say that I'm doing new 30-minute content every week, like the episodes that you've heard, my first two episodes. But the reality is that I probably can't do that right now, at least given my current schedule, because I'm working on a new book and some other projects. So my hope is that I can do a new show like the ones that I've already done every other week instead. But that said, I also have realized that I have written literally hundreds of articles on my site over the last several years, and that content would be new to the vast majority of people listening. So what I'm going to try to do is record a short form podcast in the off weeks where I share content from one of these articles that I have written in the past. And I was thinking I would pull the ones that I think are most valuable and also the ones that have been especially popular with readers. In today's episode, I want to feature the article, "If Kids Don't Understand Why Miracles Don't Discredit the Bible, Their Faith Will Be Easily Crushed." So it's really important that kids have a thoughtful understanding of the subject of miracles in general, but it's something that's rarely talked about in church. Kids learn miracle stories descriptively. In other words, they know what the Bible says from everything that they hear in Sunday school, but they rarely learn why it's even reasonable to believe in miracles. And so that's really what this article is about, and I hope that it will be helpful to you. And I'm sure I'll throw in some extra commentary along the way based on the original. But let me read you this quote from a site devoted to atheism so you can see why this lack of teaching on miracles and how to think of them is so problematic for kids given what they'll encounter today. So this is a quote from an atheist website. They say this: "The light of common sense, thrown on the stories of making snakes out of rods, of the Red Sea dividing itself, of Christ's making wine from water, curing blind men by rubbing spit in their eyes, walking on water, the story of the flood, God's making the world in 6 days, of making a woman from Adam's rib, and all the mythical, miraculous stories of the Bible would cause any sensible man to question the veracity of the whole book, including all the stories of the gods, spirits, angels, devils, and the things that common sense tell us are not true." This quote is similar to so many that I have received from skeptics over the years. The basic claim is this: Christianity defies common sense. In other words, the very existence of miracle claims in the Bible immediately discredits it. Now, there are many Christians and skeptics engaging in deeper, more scientific or philosophical battles online, but these simplistic appeals to common sense are the down and dirty weapons that are often hurled through social media. So you don't need to know one thing about logic, theology, history, biblical scholarship, philosophy, or science to cobble together an emotionally impactful statement that can make someone feel utterly stupid for what they believe. That's why appeals to common sense can be so powerful. They're easy and they're effective, and it's really easy for these things to affect your kids. The general message is that what Christians believe is so ridiculous, anyone with just a little common sense can see it's not true. Common sense is presented as a one-size-fits-all bulldozer against faith. So if your kids haven't been trained to think critically about the nature of miracles, their faith can be easily crushed by that bulldozer. So I'm going to share with you a 10-step framework. Yes, 10 steps. Just stick with me. They're brief. To help your kids think well about this subject. Each point builds on the last. So this is sort of building a cumulative case for understanding miracles in the Bible. And you can use these brief explanations to discuss a point each day on the way to school or around the dinner table, however you want to work it into your home. And I've had several people ask me to do more in future episodes on how to actually incorporate these things into your day-to-day life, and I will definitely be doing this. But for now, I just want to share this framework for thinking about miracles in general. So here's where it starts. Number one, just because something sounds crazy, that doesn't mean it's false. This is just sort of a mental starting point before we even get to having a discussion about miracles. A practical example of this is that we live on a big rock that juts around the sun at an average speed of 66,000 miles per hour, and we don't feel a thing. So if our test for truth is what happens to make sense to us, we will indiscriminately reject almost any idea that strikes us as weird. So instead, we need to look at what evidence there is for the truth of any claim. If you listen to my last episode about teaching kids non-Christian worldviews, I talked about this a bit when it came to the end of the episode when I was saying that we have to be really careful not to laugh at what other people believe or think that it's funny that people believe, for example, in reincarnation, that your grandma could come back as a cow or something like that. It's really important not to do that because we believe in some things that sound really crazy too if you're not used to thinking about it that way. So it's important to start off by just asserting that things aren't true or false based on how crazy they sound to us. Number two, people use the word miracle in a lot of different ways, so it's important to define it as it relates to biblical claims. So philosophers can argue all day about the most appropriate definition of a miracle, but for all intents and purposes, a good working definition is this, and this is the definition that I use with my kids when I do talks on this and everywhere else: an extraordinary event with a supernatural cause. So in other words, it's something that doesn't normally happen. It's extraordinary, and it has a cause from outside of nature, a supernatural cause. This is very different than the colloquial ways in which people sometimes use the word. So for example, we might say that it's a miracle our kids cleaned their room, but when we're talking about the kinds of miracle accounts found in the Bible, we need to be really clear that we're specifically talking about claims that God, a supernatural cause, intervened in the world in an extraordinary way. Now, that definition is important for setting us up for our next 2 points. Number three, if God doesn't exist, miracles are not possible. So given the definition of a miracle, if nothing exists beyond nature, in other words, nothing supernatural exists, then miracles aren't possible because there's nothing outside of nature to cause that event to happen. This is interestingly where Christians can find common ground with skeptics. When skeptics say miracles aren't possible, it's typically because they're assuming God doesn't exist. So we can simply reply, yes, if nothing such as God exists outside of nature, and a miracle is something with a cause from beyond nature by definition, then I agree with you. Miracles by definition wouldn't be possible, but you're assuming that nothing supernatural exists. That leads us then to point four. If God does exist, then miracles are possible. So the flip side of the logic we just saw in point three is that if a supernatural being such as God does exist, then miracles are, once again, by definition, possible. God can choose to intervene in his creation in any way he sees fit. Note that in this point and the last one, we're only talking about logic. This is really important to understand. We haven't even made any claims about whether or not God actually exists. And this logical framework is really helpful for kids to understand. I began teaching this kind of thinking to my kids when they were just in kindergarten. And it was this simple. Hey, I want you to understand that if God exists, miracles are possible. If God doesn't exist, miracles are not possible. It's that simple. We haven't even gotten to talking about any kind of evidence. We're just helping them think critically about the nature of what a miracle is and what would make a miracle possible. So that brings us to point five. The possibility of miracles is, therefore, tied to the evidence for God's existence. We can now see from those last 2 points that the question of whether or not miracles are possible is ultimately a question of the evidence for God's existence. If there's good reason to believe that God exists, then there's good reason to believe that miracles are possible. Now, that should, of course, lead us to ask the question, well, how do we know that God does exist? And it's outside the scope of what I can talk about in this episode as to the pieces of evidence for God's existence. But if that's something that you're interested in, I go into that in detail in my book, Talking with Your Kids About God. The whole first section lays out the pieces of evidence for God's existence, or at least several key ones that your kids can understand, and has conversation guides with every chapter. So I encourage you to check that out if that's something that you're interested in learning more about. Now, moving on, point six, believing that miracles are possible doesn't mean Christians believe every miracle claim that is made. So skeptics sometimes think that Christians are willing to believe anything is a miracle if we believe that miracles are even possible. So this point bears mentioning. When we acknowledge that if God exists, miracles are possible, we are not saying we believe every miracle claim people make. If we did, we would be gullible, just like skeptics often claim we are. We have to look at the evidence to determine if there's good reason to believe a miracle actually happened in any given case. Now, you might have noticed that we haven't even talked about the miracles in the Bible yet. So this has been a whole lot of setup for just critically thinking about the nature of miracles, what a miracle is, what would make a miracle possible before we even get to the point of talking about the Bible. And it's all of this that we've been talking about that is so often missed in Sunday school or even in church for adults, that these things are rarely talked about, yet this is the level of the discussion that's often taking place when skeptics are challenging Christians on miracles, when they say, I don't care what you have to say about what's in the Bible. It's just that miracles don't happen. They're not possible. And it flattens the conversation because so many Christians have no idea what to do with that. They just say, well, I believe in the Bible and the Bible claims these miracles happened. And so therefore I believe in them. So all of this more, philosophical stuff that we've been talking about is really important as a starting point for actually getting into what the Bible says. So now that brings us to the last few points where we are going to get into those miracle claims. Number 7, the truth of Christianity depends on the truth of one miracle, just one. So if we need to test miracle claims, as we just discussed, then we need to be really clear on which miracle claims ultimately have bearing on the truth of Christianity. People often get caught up in discussing modern day miracles or lack thereof, but there is only one miracle claim that is the ultimate test for the truth of Christianity. And here's what it is. The resurrection. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:14, if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. In other words, we can pack our bags and go home. None of this matters. We don't need to think of Jesus as a good teacher or anything like that. If he was not bodily raised from the dead, Christianity is not true. It's a false religion and none of it matters. So the resurrection is the ultimate truth test for Christianity. And it's a miracle claim. That's why all these other points we've been talking about are so important, because the truth of Christianity itself rests on a miracle. So this is an important turning point in this whole conversation, this whole framework about miracles, to go from the philosophical underpinnings to then identifying, okay, but which miracle is really important that we're starting with as a truth test for Christianity? And now let's talk about the evidence for that. Our point number 8 is that there is strong historical evidence for the resurrection. So now that we've established the miracle claim we need to test, we have to consider the evidence for it. There are several historical facts surrounding the resurrection that nearly all scholars agree on. And this is both Christian scholars and skeptical scholars. So we're not just talking about what Christians believe. These are historical data points that everyone who studies this subject, or nearly everyone who studies this subject, will look at and say, yes, I believe that this is historically a fact. So for example, Jesus died by crucifixion. This is something that you don't have to be a Christian to believe, that anyone who's knowledgeable of this subject can look at and say the historical evidence is such that we can be confident saying Jesus died by crucifixion. So there are a handful of these facts, and I talk about these facts in my book, Talking With Your Kids About Jesus, my most recent book, and I go through them and I explain what each of them is, and then we ask the question, what is the best explanation for these facts? A good one to help kind of process what we're talking about here is the fact that the disciples at least believed that Jesus rose and appeared to them. So nearly every scholar will concede this. That doesn't mean that every scholar believes that Jesus actually did appear to them, but rather that there's significant evidence that the disciples were willing to suffer and die, to risk their very lives, to proclaim this message that they had seen a resurrected Jesus. So that at least speaks to their credibility, that they weren't just lying, because they were willing to put everything on the line for proclaiming this message. So when we look at these different historical facts laid out, the pertinent question is this: what's the best explanation for the facts that we have? And a lot of explanations have been offered, naturalistic explanations, ones that don't appeal to anything supernatural. And each of these chapters in this section of my book goes through and explains what that is. So, for example, some people have suggested that the disciples were simply hallucinating. And so I take each of these and show why none of these naturalistic explanations actually account well and fully for the historical data that we have. And what you end up seeing is that unless you have already counted out the possibility of a supernatural resurrection, because you have already assumed that God doesn't exist and assumed that miracles aren't possible, a supernatural resurrection is the best explanation for the historical data that we have. So again, if you want more information on this and explain this with conversation guides for your kids and working through this methodically, I have a whole section on it in Talking with Your Kids About Jesus. So these first 8 points have gotten us all the way through evidence for the resurrection, the most important miracle claim for Christianity. But there are a lot of other miracle claims in the Bible. And so that's what these last 2 points of the framework address. Number 9, there is strong evidence for the reliability of the New Testament in general. So the Gospels describe a lot of different miracle accounts. If we have good evidence that the Gospel writers were credible eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus, then we have good evidence of those miracles. And that's exactly what we find. So I give an introduction to the subject of New Testament reliability in chapters 25 through 28 of Keeping Your Kids in God's Side, if you have that book. But if you're looking for a whole full book-length treatment on New Testament reliability, I highly recommend the book Cold Case Christianity by J. Warner Wallace. And there's also a kids version available for 8 to 12-year-olds. It's one of those rare apologetics for kids books. So I highly recommend those for a resource on the reliability of the New Testament. For those of you who have already read Cold Case Christianity, an excellent book that looks at New Testament reliability from another angle is called Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts, and that's by Lydia McGrew. So I highly recommend that as well. And finally, Jesus validated the truth of the Old Testament. So you may be wondering about the many Old Testament miracle accounts. What about talking animals, burning bushes, walls falling around Jericho, all of these kinds of things? If we've established the last couple of points, we can also establish the truth of the Old Testament as a whole because Jesus himself validated it. Jesus, number one, he appealed to the Old Testament as a source of authority. You can look at Matthew chapter 4. He acknowledged the need to correctly understand Scripture in Matthew 22. He referenced the existence of Old Testament persons like Adam and Eve and Noah and Jonah. He said he didn't come to abolish the quote-unquote law or prophets, which is a term for the scriptures at the time. You can see Matthew 5:7 on that. And he taught how the Old Testament bears witness to himself. In other words, once we get to establish the New Testament reliability within that New Testament that we can trust, Jesus' words themselves point to the authority of the Old Testament. The bottom line is that miracle accounts simply don't automatically discredit the Bible. Anyone who thinks that they do has not thought critically about the subject. There's much more to this to consider. So please help your kids understand that so they're prepared the next time that someone tries to make them feel like a fool by making simplistic appeals to quote-unquote common sense. I know that I have covered a lot in these 10 points, and I know that there's so much more to say, especially when we get into the evidence for God's existence and the evidence for the resurrection. I kept kind of pointing you off to different books and resources, but the point that I hope you get from this episode is really just the framework for thinking about these things. If you feel overwhelmed by learning apologetics because of all the details of the data and getting into the historical facts and these kind of things, I really recommend that you focus instead on pulling back and looking at a framework like this, because then that gives you an approach to how to talk about these subjects, how to think about these subjects. And that, honestly, from my perspective, is far more important for our kids to understand so that they have that mindset. They can always go to a book to look at all the specifics and how do you rebut this claim or that, or why didn't the apostles hallucinate, those kinds of things. But having a framework in mind is far more helpful because it's something that they can carry along with them for a long time to come. I hope that this episode has been helpful to you. And if it has, I'd really appreciate if you would share about the new podcast with your friends to help me get the word out about it. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk with you soon.